The explosion was ordered on the 4th of August, 1972. And looking back, we know that there was sort of a initial reluctance of countries like Britain to accept their passport holders. Why do you think that was? And reflecting back on that, and also the international reaction and stuff like that, how was that shaped by attitudes at the time? And what do you think it tells us about the governments at the time and stuff like that?
Yeah. Let's take Britain first. I think Britain was going through its own changes. You had Enoch Powell at the time, his Rivers of Blood speech. Britain was seeing immigrants coming in. And I don't know if at any particular time did they ever reflect on what will happen if everybody who had a British passport came back home, came to Britain. So I think that that type of fear-mongering was part of the culture in this country. And I think Enoch Powell played it to the hilt. And then you had the, the movement against immigration. It was called
National Front.
National Front, thank you very much. National Front was quite active at that time. The unions were also part of that feeling. You'd find that punks would get up and go into areas and beat people up. That was the culture at that time. So to look at the British government's ability at that time to accept non-white group of people, and don't forget 1968, when they started the first Commonwealth Immigrations Act, created the scare feeling among the Indians of Kenya, among the governments of East Africa, and also in Britain. So that 68, 69, 70 was a period where people just said that, well, what's going to happen? If Britain closes the door, the Asians can't come out. So by closing the door, they're going to precipitate the Indians leaving, which is exactly what happened. In Kenya, they left in 68. Rishi Sunak and all of their family came in 68. They are part of that process. Ironically enough, he should be the Prime Minister today. But at that time, Rishi's parents came in that group. I don't know about Suvela Braverman. I'm not sure if they came at that time. So that is the context at that time. Now, Britain probably took the point of view that if push comes to shove, we'll address the issue when it arises on our table. Which is a classic British way of looking at things. They're not going to say, here's a plan, and if those people turn up, we'll make space for them. I think that, talking from just my own understanding, they must have said, well, if it's not a problem, you don't need to solve it now. When the problem arises, we'll look at it. And from 68 onwards, those Asian men were not allowed to come into the country. The case was taken to the European court, and it was a continuing saga. All right. So Britain at that time immediately was not in a position to want to take the East African Indians. They were very clear about it. To Edward Heath's great credit, that he said, no, it's a moral and a legal obligation. We have to meet this obligation. I think around 17th of October was when the first plane arrived at Stansted. It was immediately after Heath signed the document to say, we have a moral and a legal obligation, we will allow them to come in. And to Britain's credit, and I say this again objectively and with all due respect, that it's wonderful that they had this vision, or the, not more than vision, I don't think it's vision, it had this moral commitment, moral understanding. It's not a vision. Moral understanding needs an inner thinking. You don't need your brain, you need your heart, you need your soul. I think this is what was very interesting, that they accepted. But don't forget, that was much later than when Canada responded. Canada responded much earlier. But if you look at the program we did, the Canadians had sent people to East Africa in 1971. Malloy was playing tennis already in Nairobi with Jalal Jaffer earlier. So, or squash. So the Canadians were already watching the scene very carefully. And they probably said, if we had to take people, let's understand how our office should work in Africa. The United Nations came in a little later, and that's where Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan was quite a visionary. He was not only the High Commissioner for Refugees, but he understood the dynamics of post-war refugee issues, which originally were only to do with a particular type of convention refugee. 1951 spoke of you as a convention refugee. I know that convention because I myself couldn't get refugee status in Canada. They said, you're not a convention refugee. You should be running past a barbed wire. Your one leg should be filled with blood. And you should be in immediate fear of being killed. I didn't come in that category. So I didn't get position refugee status in Canada. Prince Sadruddin was very, very instrumental in exploring what the United Nations calls alternative pathways to resettlement. And that's where countries like Spain, Sweden, Malta, Austria, Italy, they came in that category, where they took small groups of people and said, we'll give them immediate refuge, pending their getting resettled. So the European countries became a point of immediate arrival. And those who could absorb, they absorbed. Those that other countries that had relatives could take, they allowed that to happen. So I think the European countries played an intermediate role, A, through their openness, and B, through Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan's thinking through the out of the box. So you find the United Nations played a role, but the United Nations didn't play a major demographic role because they didn't, I don't think they had more than about 4,000 or 5,000 people that they had killed. The big bulk was Britain with about 28,606 people, and Canada that took about 6,000 or 7,000 people. So I still don't know where the other numbers are. People say 80,000. And when you look at Britain with 28,000, Canada with 6, and the United Nations with another 5 or 6, where do you get the numbers from? But whatever they were, the point is that these countries now began to respond on a symptomatic basis. I don't think any of them, if you ask me, had a plan. They were dealing with the issue on a symptomatic basis, on a day-to-day basis, largely out of the compassion in their hearts, a readiness to see the world changing, a readiness to play a role as part of a global network of people concerned about migrations. I don't think anybody had a fixed plan. Today we can attribute a plan to them. I don't think there was a plan at that time.
And so you touched on that you eventually went to Canada. How did that unfold, and how did that end up, and what was that process like?
In my case, you know, I was a qualified English lawyer, and part of my family left. You know, I told you in 1971, I got my permission to live in, to work in Kenya. My sister was a legal secretary in Kenya. The plan of the family was that my sister and I would both go to Canada and open a new front for the family, so that when the rest of the family arrives there, you have two people there, my sister and myself. I had another sister in Canada who was there a year earlier, or two sisters rather. So the family was in the throes of moving from East Africa to Canada, not to England, to Canada. In my case, I couldn't leave because I came to realize that if I left at that time, I had a lot of work of clients. I had a lot of money in my clients' account that belonged to clients. Work was not finished. I was doing a lot of property work, conveyancing work. So I decided I will stay back and finish the work rather than leaving halfway, creating discomfort with people. I didn't know who to give the work to or the money to. You know, law is a very personal thing. When you're running a one-man office or a small office, do you take your client's amount and give it to another lawyer? God forbid tomorrow, if that lawyer runs away with this money, what do you do? You're responsible to about 20, 30 people. I didn't want to go through that. So I made the decision that I will give up my landed status, stay in Kenya, finish the work, and after finishing the work, I gave my practice to an African lawyer. I didn't sell it, I gave it away. But this African lawyer who took my practice was a very, very kind person. He said, look, I will allow you to work in the office without paying any rent because you're giving me the practice. But you finish the work you have, and new work that I get will be mine. And he said, if nothing works for you overseas and you come back to East Africa, you can come back to the office. I'll give you a job. He was very kind. He didn't have the money. He said, I don't have the money to buy you out. I said, look, I don't want you to spend money to buy me out. I said, just give me enough safeguards that if nothing works with me, then what I'm giving you is not something lost to me. And he was very open. He said, look, we are like brothers. Just to give an example how Indian and African could work. I mean, there he was, a black man. He was a Tanzanian. He said, look, he says, Muhammad, he said, what you're giving me is what you earned. He said, I have to be fair to you. If you come back, I'll give you the big office. I said, no, big office will be yours. Give me an office at the back. So there was that understanding. And I decided to go to Canada. But my problem was that Canada did not recognize a British barrister at law qualification for practicing. They said, if you want to practice in Canada, you have to do an LLB at a Canadian university for 3 years. But I said, but I can practice at the High Court of England. Theoretically, I could become the Attorney General of England. Literally, theoretically, I could be the Attorney General of England with the qualification I had. And yet the Canadian said, you can't even practice in Toronto with that qualification. You've got to go back to law school. So you see the structural inbuilt inequities that I had to contend with. And I'm going to be honest enough here that Canadian structural inequities were very much to keep people out of the legal profession. It's a reality. There's nothing magical about it. I've written about it. But I had to contend with that. So what happened? I went to Canada. And I had very, very little money. And I couldn't get a scholarship because I wasn't a Canadian. I wasn't a Commonwealth citizen. I wasn't a South African and I wasn't a Kenyan. So I had to pay from my own pocket. And after having practiced in Kenya, I ended up in Canada on a Saturday morning selling hot dogs to earn money to pay for my books. I did it. I mean, I did it. I'm not ashamed about it. I did it. I qualified. I was maybe, I don't know, I may have been about top 10% of my class. I got my Canadian LLB. That was a long time ago. After that, I went to LLM. I did a PhD. I went to do courses at the International Court of Justice in The Hague and all that. Oh, that was all in the future. But at that particular time, I had no money. I had to really struggle. I had to buy my books by working in some place in the street. But I did it because I wanted to qualify as a lawyer. I didn't want to end up in Canada picking up dustbins. That was not what I was there for. And so I had to go through the whole loop, and I didn't get my Canadian language status immediately. I had to then apply at the end of qualification. So that took me another 3-4 years. But I'm not bitter about it. All I'm saying is that we had to be culturally and politically savvy. We had to survive. There was no choice. I mean, I couldn't stand in Canada and say, oh, well, I was the vice president of the Debating Society of Gray's Inn. I got the highest ratings, which I did. I'm only telling you in context that I got the highest ratings in property law from all the Inns of Court lawyers. I got the fourth highest ranking in contract and tort. And I got the highest ranking in a third criminal law, contract and tort, and property law. But yet I was told by Canada that and the irony is that Osgoode Hall Law School is named after William Osgoode, who was from Lincoln's Inn. Now you can see the anomaly. You can see the actual anomaly that here I am as a highly trained British barrister from a 600-year inn, Gray's Inn, which was twice as old as the whole country of Canada. And I'm told you can't practice law without going to law school. So at the end of the day, what do you do? Go to law school. I went to law school.
If I'm not mistaken, the sort of wave of Ugandan Asians that Canada took in was the first major sort of non-European immigration that country had. Were you in Canada for the rest of the 70s? Did you see sort of a change in society there from that immigration? A change in attitudes towards non-European immigration? How was it on the ground in Canada?
Max, slowly. Very slowly. Very slowly. Canada today is a country that espouses pluralism. It is quite open about it. But let us also be aware that Canada was a society that espoused racism at one time as well. Talk to any indigenous person in Canada, you'll get the story loud and clear. Listen to the recent Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There are 93 items that need rectification. I don't think they've gone beyond 8 or 9. So let us not be oblivious. Let us be aware that Canada did play a role. And people who love Canada love it beyond imagining, because they said Canada opened its doors, it's most loving, wonderful, that's exactly what it did. But we must be realistic that immediately post-expulsion, there was racism in Canada. I remember a chap, and I can't recall his name now, his first name was Shamshu. He was a chap who was pushed onto the railway tracks in Toronto, called a Pecky, and both his legs were broken. Only for the reason that he happened to be on that platform and happened to be coffee-colored instead of, you know, pure white. This reality was there. So there were pockets of racist feelings in Canada. But to Canada's credit, I've always said that Canada is a country that espouses a multi-pluralistic vision. For every one person who may sound racist, there would be 6 or 7 people who would stand up, which is a great hope for the future. So as time went by, don't forget they came 50 years ago. Over a 50-year period today now, you have the first Governor General of Alberta happens to be an Ismaili woman, Salma Lakhani. You have the first mayor of Calgary, or first South Asian mayor of Calgary, Nayid Nancy, came as a 1-year-old child with his mother. They are now, many of those people, children of the immigrants of Uganda, who are now in the Foreign Service. Not all of them, but 3 or 4 I can count. Some of them are in government. But it's been a 50-year trajectory. It wasn't an overnight epiphany to say, all right, you guys are all great. You arrived 3 weeks ago. Now you've got a job already. You're running a Dunkin' Donut and your son is at a good school. It wasn't that way. I think if you read the literature of people today, you will see that people went through a lot of difficulties. They went through difficulties. But Canada, over and above, became for these people a very enabling place. They did see difficulty, but they also saw the ability to overcome that difficulty through hard work, through making friends, through developing a civic consciousness or expressing a civic commitment and meeting other good-minded people. But Canada had its trajectory. It wasn't overnight. And I think that Walter Stewart has written a brilliant book on this called Oh No, Not in Canada. There's a book that Walter Stewart, a journalist, has written, and I would recommend if you can get hold of that book, have a look at it. Canada has its own experiences of what they did with the Japanese, what they did with the Komagatu Maru boat, you know, 300 plus Punjabis who came from India. Well, the boat was sent back. They were told they'll blow the boat up if they didn't leave. All these are racial blots on the horizon, which we can't overlook. We can contextualize them. We need to understand them, and we don't need to be stuck with them. But we need to understand that that wasn't a society that was totally free of racist thinking. That's a reality.
And so now, 50 years later, if we now think about the modern day and reflection and your relationship with East Africa and South Asians, and why do you think it's so important that history is like that of East African Asians and of the Ugandan Asians and the expulsion are taught, and what can we still learn from those?
I think the East African Asian situation, for me, has two dimensions of learning. The one dimension of learning is the more universal dimension of learning, where people tend to look at immigrants always in a negative light. Immigration is always seen in not as an asset, it's been seen as a deficit. There's a deficit dimension of the understanding. They will come here, they'll take our jobs away, they won't integrate, they'll do this, they'll do that. There's always the negative dimension. And yet when I see the history of the 20th century, everywhere you've seen great developments, it's always been immigrants. Whether they're white immigrants, brown immigrants, black immigrants, I don't care. The point is that immigrants bring a new vigor into an area. And when you think of people like the great musicians, think of people like Leopold Stokowski, if I'm not mistaken, even Walt Disney, I may be wrong, but people who've come from one part of the world to another part of the world have always, Albert Einstein himself is a case in point. Einstein is a case in point. He was a German immigrant who came to America. Then you think of great musicians today like Yo-Yo Ma, Lang Lang. Think of at the end of the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, Tamara Karsavina, Matilda Shashinskaya, all these great ballet dancers who came to France from this ex-Soviet Union were people who brought new vigor into the country. And I'm talking at the higher echelon. If you go deeper down, I mean, take our own country here. Going to any medical practice today, you're going to see outstanding doctors, people in their fields who are from different cultures, not necessarily non-European cultures, but different cultures. So at the universal level, I think Uganda gives an idea of an asset-based approach to immigration. We tend to over-dramatize the greatness of the Ugandan Asians. I think they also had problems. They also have had failings. Not everyone is a success. But I think by and large, you can talk about a group that came to this country, did not want to be stuck in the camps, did not want to be stuck in council housing, wanted to improve their lot in life and were able to do it. But that doesn't mean that every one of us must be walking around with a sandwich board and say, we did it, we're great. We got to be understanding of other immigrants who do not have that opportunity of family, solidarity, of village networks, of the ability of the families to work together. We need to be sympathetic to others who don't have that opportunity and work towards helping them to be able to find a space. So that's at the one level. That my approach would be, yes, I understand countries have their absorptive capacity. I'm not here for unbridled movements of people, but I'm here for compassion. I'm here, let's be compassionate. Let's not wait till that one child drowns in the Mediterranean for all of us to say, well, what can we do? We need to be compassionate because every one of that children could be our son, could be our daughter, could be our grandchild, could be our mother, could be our sister. I think we need to extend that compassion as human beings beyond our own little group. So that is at the level of universality and migration. Now at the level of specificity, I think Uganda is critical because you have today Asian minorities in South Africa, Botswana, Guyana, Trinidad, Fiji, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Madagascar, and I think it's important for Indian minorities in ex-colonial territories to understand the structures in which they were placed and which structures have not dissipated. And today they are now seen as the only group making money. And if the larger populace see themselves as being deprived in any way, then these small minorities are going to stand out as being the exploiters. And I think Indian communities actually have to know their history. They have to understand their situation contextually in the colonial context. that they need to learn from what happened in the past to say, what should we do now? If we were not able to do what we were meant to do 50 years ago, are we in a better position today to do something so that we don't repeat what happened in the past? To me, that is important. That is very important. If today somebody says, oh, well, I live in Uganda, but I'm not worried about Uganda. I live in a gated community. I'm from India. I'm here. I'm running an IT business. And it doesn't matter. I would say no. I would say no, don't do that. Because you're going to place yourself in a worse position than where the people were 50 years ago. If you're living in this country, if this country is responsible for giving you your bread on your table, then make sure that that bread has a little piece for those people who don't have a piece to eat. I'm not saying don't go into entrepreneurialism. Entrepreneurship is very good. One has to make money, but how do you make your money? Do you make your money at the cost of anything? Or do you make your money in a way that you can make the people who work with you feel that we have skin in this? If we do this, we will enlarge the pie. And as you enlarge the pie, there are more people who can enjoy it. They will protect it. That is my philosophy. And that is what I would say, that the Ugandan crisis is something very valuable for places like South Africa. There's about 1.2, 1.3 million Indians in South Africa. What is going to be their future tomorrow if something goes wrong? It could go wrong. Could easily go wrong. And people can't say that, oh, it won't happen here. Our demography is different. We have a different type of constitution. I told them you could have the best constitution in the world. Once the economic situation starts collapsing, once people start going into the street and start breaking into shops and killing people on the road, the rage will be so great that you're not going to wait till the Constitutional Court decides on an issue. We saw that in America last year. So I think that these are issues that human societies, we have to be aware of in today's global context, where there's such cut down, where people are struggling from deprivation, where young children are going without food. And I think when you see those type of situations, civil society has a positive obligation to ensure that there are sufficient bulwarks to promote greater collaboration, greater understanding, so that issues don't become unnecessarily racist, they don't become unnecessarily polemical. I think that for a more healthy society, we have to have a greater and a more committed civil society that looks at individuals not only using their education to make money or their position to be entrepreneurial, but to be more civic, to be more thoughtful, to be more conscious of what it means to be human and to contribute towards the structures of society to bring about greater understanding.
Finally, I wanted to ask, why do you think Idi Amin as a person was so forthright and aggressive towards the Ugandan Asian population?
You know, that's a question that I don't think anybody's really deeply tried to probe. There are different views that come up, that he was in love with an Indian woman and then they sent her away and he felt very much aggrieved and very much disrespected. My own interview shows very authentically that that was not true. I wouldn't like to give names now, but somebody close to the scene says that was something that was, they think that was something that was set up by the media. It wasn't absolutely true. Now, whether it's true or not, I think we need to try and probe a little deeper, that what did Idi Amin feel that he reacted the way he did? One thing I think is to try and understand why he reacted the way he did presupposes that Idi Amin thought what he was doing. And I don't think he was a person of a long-range thinking process. Idi Amin, I think, from what I've never met him, but from what I've come to understand from the people who met him or knew him, is that he wasn't a person of long-range thinking. I think if he was, he would not have made a declaration of telling people to leave for 90 days when the Indians were so critical to Uganda's economy and to East Africa's economy for so many decades. I mean, the Indians were there during the Portuguese period, they were there during the Zenji Empire, they were there during the British period in Tanzania and Kenya, they were there during the German period. So I think that I would be a little cautious to attribute to Idi Amin too many long-term thinking for what he did. Now, one can look at the context in which he was operating to say, why did he do what he did? I think one has to remember that at the time when he came on, Obote was moving towards the common man's charter, and Uganda was veering towards a socialist camp. Perhaps at that time, geopolitically, the Western world did not want East Africa to be too polarized. So that is one thing to keep in mind. Number two, when Idi Amin came on the scene, there was a lot of jubilation. Indians, blacks, everybody were happy. They said, wow, this guy is going to now make sure that what Obote was trying to do by nationalizing the banks and all Indian businesses and white businesses, maybe he will put a halt to it. So I think Idi Amin came on the scene very much like being the grand old daddy. I mean, he used to go around in a jeep and told people he'll solve their problems. If they have matrimonial problems, phone me up, I'll come and solve it. He was quite gregarious. He was funny in a way. I'm told to believe when the Indians went to him with this big petition, which they spent 2 or 3 or 4 weeks preparing, he took the petition, just put it one side, and he said, I've cooked some curry for you. Let me give you the curry I've prepared. You know, he was quite earthy and funny. In a way, he was quite funny, he was entertaining. I think that as he took over, the conditions in the country were very problematic. The security, the law and order situation was very, very pathetic. There was what is known as condoism. A lot of robberies were taking place. People were being killed. So you had a lot of robberies that the country could not handle at that time. There were tribal difficulties. A lot of tribal difficulties. There were economic problems the country was facing. And then, you know, he went to Libya. Whatever he may have discussed with Gaddafi, and Gaddafi himself told him that he got rid of many people, I think the Italian community. So Idi Amin was quite mercurial, and he was quite unpredictable. One wouldn't know what was the next thing he was going to do. My feeling is that he must have thought that here is a popular issue. The Indians in East Africa. Let me see if I can try this one. And if it works, I will deflect the attention from everywhere onto something new so that we can deal with issues as they come up. But it's just that I think that the Indians were caught unprepared for this exigency. They knew it was going to happen, but not that quickly. That's number one. And I think the Western world was also caught unaware. They thought, well, look, this guy sounded like an amenable person, but he's unpredictable. And he's unpredictable, we don't know what he's going to do next. So I think everybody was caught unaware. And everybody thought that the next few weeks will suddenly subside. Everything will be okay, the storm will be blown over, we'll all be okay. So I don't think the Indian community as such felt that he was against them in any way. It's just that he found this as a popular move, and he thought, if I can pull this through, I will be a hero. And he became a hero immediately, because certain people did feel that that was the way to go. There were Africans who felt that way. They must have said, well, you need a man like him to solve this problem. If you're going to get somebody who's a World Bank thinker, it's not going to happen. Better have this guy, he'll pull the thing through. So there were those tendencies as well. Until that many Africans began to see that, look, the Indians may be able to leave and they'll have somewhere to go. I think about 93,000 Africans were killed. So you could see that the problem. And also then, Amin became difficult because of not only the geopolitical reality, but also the national political reality, because he went to war with Tanzania, started then bombarding certain areas, and said certain areas belong to Uganda. So I think that the problem became very murky at both the local, the national and the international level. And I think the global community had to deal with it. Now, how does that augur for national governments? Well, what is the position of the Indian community in Uganda at the time, which was not different from the Indian community in Tanzania and in the Indian community in Kenya and in Zanzibar? Professor Yash Tandon says the Indians were termed as stepchildren of the colonial empire. Here was a group of people who came as on the backs of colonialism. At the end of slavery and the beginning of the indentured system, 1850s, 1860s, South Africa with sugar, Kenya with railways, Uganda with the Kenya-Uganda railway line, different places with plantation economies. Amitav Ghosh writes beautifully about this. If you read the book, The Nutmeg's Curse, you'll see what I mean. That Indians came on the back of Western colonialism at the end of slavery and the beginning of the new plantation colonies, whether it's Zambia, or Rhodesia, Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, Nyasaland, or Botswana, or South Africa, or Madagascar, or Fiji, or Mauritius, you'll see the same patterns of plantation economy, plantation economics. And the point I was trying to make before I lose the thread is that, yes, how did governments look at this? How did colonial governments look at it? Well, I think colonial governments looked at it in a way by saying, we've left, we've given you independence, it's not our job. You people sort yourself out. As far as India was concerned, I think that Nehru's philosophy seems to have been a dominant factor. When in 1949 he sent his ambassador plenipotentiary to Kenya, Apapanj, to tell the Indians in East Africa that you don't belong to India, you belong to Africa. Your grandparents' forefathers went to Africa, so sort yourself out. Africa is your destiny. So Indians in East Africa couldn't look to India. So what was the responsibility of everybody? East African government said, you guys are not our responsibility, clear off, you should have left already. Western government said, we've given independence already, we have nothing to do. India says, you people left long time ago, what do you want us to do? Other governments will say, well, we have not been colonially implicated, what do you want us to do? I mean, Canada could easily say that, they didn't. But they could have said, it's not our problem, we have our own problem in Quebec and other places, East Africa is not our problem. So the Indian minorities in 1972, sadly, had nobody to speak for them. Nobody but nobody. Countries took people, some took 8 people, some took 50, some took 14, some took 30, some took 6,000, some took 28,000. They went wherever destiny took them, no different from the way their grandparents came when India had famine and drought. They went wherever the boats took them. If the boats took them to Guyana, you went to Guyana. If the boat took you to Fiji, you went to Fiji. If the boat took you to Madagascar, you went to Madagascar. If in the middle of the ocean you were shipwrecked, you went to wherever the boat took you. 2 brothers would go to one island and 6 brothers or 3 brothers would end up in another island. So 1972 for the Indians in East Africa was not different from 1872 with the Indians at the time of the end of colonialism. Western governments today may have learnt much more. Immigration policies perhaps are a bit more sophisticated today. Perhaps there's a different approach to how alternative pathways could be explored and leveraged. If you ask me today, the average Indian from East Africa doesn't have the same worry today that they had in 72. The average original East African, I'm not talking about the new Indians. If you talk about the new Indians who've come there and starting, you know, IT companies and all that, that's a different story. I'm talking about the original East African Indians but who have children, one in Dubai, one in Houston, one in New Jersey, somebody in California. These families don't have the same problem 50 years later. They've got kids all around the world. They've got their mind and their body and their soul exactly where the East African governments didn't want them. Culturally, they are close to India. Economically, they're close to the West because they have their assets in the West. And emotionally, they will go to Africa because they say, well, we're born here. We want to come here for a holiday. They're not in one place. In a global context, they're everywhere. And the East African Asian minority is a diaspora that is quite global. If you take the Marwanis, the Metas, they're not only in East Africa. They're very much in Uganda. But today, they are, to quote them, their own words. I quote Muljibai Madhvani himself, Manubai Madhvani. I met him personally. And Manubai said this to me. He said, today, we could never imagine that we could have diversified to the level we have had it not been for the expulsion. He said, Uganda expulsion opened up our minds to our own potential that we would have never even imagined that we could have done. He says, today we're doing that. So I think that the East African Indian diaspora has become rather multinational. It has become global. And I mean, just an interesting phase. If you take our prime minister in this country as an example. His parents came from Tanzania and Kenya. He was born in Southampton. He was educated in America. Then he got into politics in this country. His wife comes from a very, very prominent Indian family, and they are operating at a global level. So you can just see that that one family. In 1968, if you spoke to Rishi Sunak's father and asked him what your next 5 years going to be like, I would be surprised if he even knew that he would have something beyond a pharmacy. Beyond a pharmacy. Well, today if you talk to Rishi Sunak, you're probably going to get a totally different vision of what he saw the last 50 years as. So if Rishi Sunak is one example, might I be able to tell you that perhaps you'll find in a large segment of that demography a diversification vision, if not a plan, that embraces a number of countries, a number of professions, a number of connectivities, and where people are not beleaguered anymore. They look at not Gujarat as their home, they do not look at Uganda as their home, but they will look at, you know, Houston, New Jersey, New York, London, Copenhagen, Paris, Lisbon, as part of the world they live in.